Love Scotland, brought to you from the National Trust for Scotland, presented by Jackie Burt.
Hello and welcome to a unique link-up between the National Trust and the National Trust for Scotland. We're going to bring you a couple of perspectives on an event that was to change British history, the Battle of Culloden. On April 16th, 1746, it took just under an hour of fighting on a boggy Highland moor to end the Jacobite dream of restoring the Stuarts to the throne of Great Britain. Now, those of you with even a passing interest in history will probably know the names of Culloden's key protagonists, Prince Charles Edward Stuart and his nemesis, the Duke of Cumberland. Today, though, I'm going to talk about another key figure, not just at Culloden, but within that entire Jacobite campaign, Lieutenant General Lord George Murray. Meanwhile, you may have already heard that different view on Culloden on your usual National Trust podcast feed, telling the story of a soldier on the government side, James Wolfe, who later in his military career became known as the Hero of Quebec. But back to our tale. And for me, what makes the role of Lord George Murray so fascinating is that amid the battles of the 45 Rebellion, an internal war was being waged between Murray, who was the chief Jacobite commander, and Charles Edward Stuart himself. It was a clash of wills and personalities that some argue would have an impact on the outcome of the campaign itself. Well, my guest today to discuss Lord George Murray and his role is another Murray, Professor Murray Pittock, an historian at the University of Glasgow and author of the book simply entitled Culloden. Welcome, Murray.
Delighted to be here, Jackie.
Well, let's set the scene. Lord George Murray was born in Perth in 1694, the sixth son of the first Duke of Atholl, so not high on the family pecking order. What sort of life would have been mapped out for him?
He would have been educated at university as he was. He would have joined the army, probably, which he did. He joined the British Army as an ensign in 1711. After serving as an army officer, he would probably become a sheriff deputy, and he would be involved in the administration of justice and Atholl authority locally on behalf of his brother, who probably by that time would be the Duke.
So not something really to make a name for himself?
No. If he had stayed loyal to the British government, he would be much less famous than he is.
But even from those early years, he was always going to be a bit of a character, wasn't he? Because he ran away aged 17 to Flanders to join the army.
Yes, indeed. He was a wild one, as you might say. He spent a year at the University of Glasgow and then off he went to be a soldier.
And age 21, he took part in the 1715 rebellion, which wasn't successful, and he had to flee, really, for his life to France.
Yes, he did, and then to Rotterdam, and then he returned in 1719. He had a lieutenant colonel's commission in 1715. In 1719, he became brigadier general in the Jacobite Rising of that year, which was supported by Spain and regular Spanish troops. In that capacity, he fought at the Battle of Glenshiel, where the Jacobites were defeated by General Whiteman.
So off he went, price on his head, and for about 10 years, his father tried manfully to work behind the scenes to have him pardoned.
He did, and he made a secret visit to see his dying father before he'd been pardoned, but eventually George II pardoned him, and he was allowed back, as it were, into Atholl society under the Hanoverians in 1730, whereupon he appeared to live not just the life of a retired Jacobite, but the life of a loyal servant of the crown and working hard to get patronage for his eldest son, James, who was to go to Eton. And on the outbreak of the 1745 Rising, was actually given a captain's commission in one of the British regiments, Loudon's, though he, for understandable reasons, he never took it up.
And he also worked with the Hanoverian commander in Scotland, General Cope.
Yes, he did. He was appointed sheriff deputy to effectively root out the disaffected in 1744-45. A French invasion was expected in 1744 that didn't get through, and he worked with Cope as commander-in-chief Scotland to identify and round up disaffected Jacobites in Perthshire. He didn't actually identify any disaffected Jacobites in Perthshire. Perhaps he just spent his time looking in the mirror.
This is what I don't understand, but hopefully you can inform me of what was happening. Because he seems to have nailed his colours firmly to the Hanoverian mast. So was this the case, or was he being politically adept?
He was probably being politically adept, because there isn't very much doubt that Lord George Murray was a consistent Jacobite throughout his career. However, his closeness to the Hanoverian government certainly raised a lot of suspicions in the minds of his fellow Jacobites, many of whom had suffered inordinately, stayed out, or if they had been received back into countenance of the British government, were hardly the sort of person you would invite to parties. He was in with the woodwork. And the other thing was the transition whereby he went to Perth Grammar School and his son went to Eton was one which was beginning for the Whig aristocracy in Scotland, but which was regarded as highly suspect by the Jacobites, who fundamentally associated themselves with Scottish patriotism, Scottish values, the Scots language and Scottish tradition. So that was grounds for suspicion. And also Murray was not as keen as other Jacobites on ending the Union. So that too was grounds for suspicion. So he's a committed Jacobite, but he's always under suspicion by a proportion of the Jacobite command, and that gets worse as the rising goes on.
He went to London, didn't he, to pay homage to King George himself?
Yes, he did. He met the King in the beginning of the 1740s.
And so to 1745. Why did Murray, by then, clearly a clever man, 50-year-old man, risk everything to join the prince?
He risked everything because he was a convinced Jacobite. This is my prince, and I must fight for him.
There's a lovely quote from his wife who called him her Don Quixote.
Yes, tilting at windmills, of course, that Don Quixote is famous for. And this is one of the interesting things about Murray's commitment in the 45. Murray thought, certainly from the early mid-stage of the Rising, that the Jacobites were bound to lose.
Really?
Yes. He absolutely thought they were bound to lose.
Because I want to come on to that, whether or not he was just a pessimist or a realist in that.
He's a pessimist.
So the prince landed at Glenfinnan in the middle of August. By early September, Murray was by his side. However, he wasn't really a fan of the prince. He called him a reckless adventurer, which is another reason why I can't square the circle of someone who gave up everything to join the Jacobite rebellion when he didn't like its leader.
The issue is, I think, that a lot of people have taken Lord George Murray's assessments quite straightforwardly. And indeed, Chevalier Johnston, who is his aide-de-camp, who wrote A History of the 45, did a lot to, he's responsible for the phrase, if the prince had gone to sleep, Lord, let Lord George Murray command, he would have found the three crowns of Great Britain and Ireland on his head.
When he
woke up, yes.
How would you describe Lord George Murray?
Arrogant, determined, intelligent without having had the scope to exercise that intelligence in a lot of his career.
Was he a good soldier?
He was not a great general, which some people make out. He would have been a good battlefield commander, staff officer, junior general in a major conflict in the 18th century. He had real capacity in that direction, but he's not a military genius. He thinks he's a military genius.
Mm. And the prince?
The prince is charismatic, passionate, headstrong, very smart and gifted intellectually, very good at what would be called modern theatre politics. Employing a Gallic tutor and marching at the front of the army in tartan is all very, very... The optics were good, exactly. And liable to fall into psychosomatic illness and paddy and sulk when he didn't get his own way, and especially when he thought that the cause was being undermined by people who were overly cautious.
The progress of the Jacobite campaign was overseen by a council of war, and it just appears to be a succession of disagreements over strategy, tactics, everything.
Most Jacobite commanders didn't want to march into England. The British government were rather concerned that they would call in French troops to Edinburgh and simply re-establish a Scottish Parliament, dissolve the Union. Charles Edward Stuart persuaded a majority of one to invade England, but he worked on them till he got a small majority. He wanted to invade England because he was convinced that the military and financial power generated by London and its access to capital markets would destroy him if he didn't take it. So he was right, fundamentally. Their view was not sufficient or accurate, and his was. But then, after he'd only got a majority of one to march into England, naturally there was a huge amount of scepticism as they went further into England and the recruits didn't roll in large numbers. They were probably about 1,100 in all. And at Derby, they refused to go any further.
Should they have continued, or at the time was that the right decision?
It could never be the right decision if you were prepared to risk as much as they'd already risked. So the situation, the military situation they were facing, was they were facing a few battalions of the train bands, the Black Watch, who weren't trusted, and a few other odds and ends, frankly, at Finchley. And after that, they would have entered London. So they would certainly have got to London first, and they probably would have lost even so. But remembering that the British Army depended a great deal on troops from continental Europe who were not committed, shall we say, to the state, but were there because of Hanover and its alliances, then it's quite possible that they might have won in certain circumstances. There wasn't a big chance, but retreat and there's no chance.
Well, let's take a break there. The Jacobites are in retreat. The relationship between Charles Edward Stuart and our man George Murray is not going well, to say the least, and Culloden is yet to come. We'll be back in a moment.
Scotland's history. Think battlefields. Think castles. Think great glens and historic homes. But think tenements too, and townhouses and ducats, mills and humble cottages. The National Trust for Scotland works hard all year round to safeguard the stories of all sorts of Scots for future generations to enjoy. They do it for the love of Scotland, and you can play your part too. Just head to nts.org.uk/donate.
Welcome back. Professor Murray Pittock, we are heading for the final showdown between the retreating Jacobite army and the government troops led by the Duke of Cumberland, whose forces are chasing them towards Inverness. It seems at this point that relations between George Murray and the Prince have truly broken down.
Absolutely. They break down particularly after the final moves north of Crieff, because then the Prince discovers that George Murray's been lying about or misrepresenting the extent of desertion from the army.
Was this just to strengthen his own case, that it was the right thing to do?
It's difficult to know what his motives were, but I think he wanted out by that stage. And, for example, when he moved north, he tried to negotiate a prisoner exchange with the Prince of Hesse, who was coming in to aid Cumberland. And Hesse was quite willing to discuss it, and Cumberland was absolutely not going to discuss it. So Hesse refused to actually fight on with Cumberland's forces because they wouldn't take prisoner Cartel. But Charles Edward didn't authorise those discussions. Lord George Murray was looking for a way out by the last few weeks of the campaign.
Do you know, as we talk, I'm beginning to take the side of the Prince. It must have been a heavy load to bear. This is your chief strategic commander, and from the beginning he seems to be the voice of doom. We haven't got a hope. We shouldn't go further. We shouldn't go into England. Now we should turn back. Oh, let's turn back here. Oh, let's turn back at Derby.
And it was combined, of course, with the fact that Murray and his allies in the council disliked the Irish officers, and chiefly John Sullivan, who was the quartermaster general.
Who had the other ear of the Prince.
Who had the other ear of the Prince. But then Sullivan was, and continued to be when he returned to the continent, a lifetime French regular with extensive experience of guerrilla warfare, particularly in Corsica. So there is a modern view that actually Sullivan was not so bad at all. And the Lord George Murray supporters trace Sullivan as entirely incompetent. But again, Sullivan looks as if he was a pretty decent staff officer. He just didn't agree with Lord George Murray, and the Prince trusted him and not Lord George.
And the fact that this entire Council of War was just full of divisions and rancour.
Yes.
The site of the Battle of Culloden in that boggy moor that I talked about in the introduction, with no hope of a successful Highland charge. The clans that charge that had proven successful in battles like Preston Pans. Who chose that site? And did Murray have anything to do with it?
So there is the story, which is not usually told about Culloden, is there is a fight over the site. Cumberland is approaching Nairn. Inverness is the last considerable borough the Jacobites hold. They've got to block the road to Inverness is the rational thing. So the first thing they choose is a site at Dalcross Castle, which is towards Nairn. And then Sullivan vetoes that because there's a ravine, and the ravine is less than 50 metres across. And so that's within effective musket range. So he thinks that they could be trapped in a firefight. So he vetoes that. Then Lord George Murray tries to enlist Irish officers who are not Sullivan to go and look at a site on the other side of the Nairn, which doesn't defend the road and looks like a prelude to retreat. And they all say, well, this won't do because, I mean, I've been to that site. It's an awful site. And then they line up about a kilometre east where the land is drier on the 15th of April, and Sullivan approves that site. And then the night attack is called.
Yes. Let's talk in a bit more detail about that night attack. It was a cunning plan on the eve of battle. What was it, and what was Murray's involvement?
So Murray and Prince effectively led two columns to carry out the night attack on Cumberland's camp. It was Cumberland's birthday, and their supposition was that a large portion of the soldiers would be very drunk.
And that wasn't the case, was it? It didn't turn out like that.
No, they were not. I mean, a surprise attack might nonetheless have worked if they managed it, but Cumberland was a better and also stricter, more puritanical commander than to allow all the soldiers to get drunk on his birthday. So Murray called his column to retreat because it was too late.
And how many men were in the column?
Roughly speaking, they're about 2,000 to 2,500 in each column.
So two columns set off under cover of darkness to try to ambush the government troops before they woke up. Is that the case?
That's right. They had set off late because it's April and the Royal Navy was in the Murray Firth, so they could be seen by telescope as long as it was light.
So they set off. And weren't there a few stragglers and one of the columns was going much faster than the other and had to keep stopping?
Yes, that's right.
It sounds farcical.
Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Was this Murray's idea?
No, Murray consents to it. And indeed, he in some accounts, he suggests it. I suspect it emerged as an option. But the difficulty was that the Scottish and Irish regiments in the French service and some of the Lowland regiments couldn't really go over rough ground in complete darkness at the pace that some of the units who were closer to home could. And so one of the columns got much closer than the other. The closer column could see the sentries, but Lord George Murray, by that time, it was notified to the prince that Lord George Murray had called a retreat, effectively, of the other column. A surprise attack with 2,500 men, with terrific skills in hand-to-hand combat in the early morning, might conceivably have worked.
What was the size of Cumberland's army?
It was 9,000 officially, but probably a bit closer to 7,500 to 8,000 in terms of... There's a gap between official strength and the number of people who are actually there.
I've got a line from a Jacobite soldier who described the night march to Nairn as one of confusion and disorder. Does that sum it up, or am I being unkind? Or was he being unkind?
It depends which part of the army you were in. I mean, that was one of the reasons the prince saw it as a betrayal, that, you know, one of the columns couldn't make progress and the other one did make reasonable progress. But it was always too tight an ask to walk several miles over rough ground in the dark when dawn is reasonably early and dusk is reasonably late.
So Murray and his column, they got back to base camp, to Culloden at dawn, yes?
Yes, well, a bit after dawn.
And the other column that hadn't been told that they'd turned back, they were still following behind.
They were informed that Murray had turned back and Prince was livid. And then they turn back. And so what you have is the prince goes to Culloden House for breakfast with his officers. He and they are tired out. A lot of Jacobites just fall asleep in clumps, but they fall asleep by Culloden House, which is actually a kilometre further west towards Inverness than the site chosen by Sullivan the previous day when the troops were put in battle order. So then they, and they're still soldiers trying to come back. Their soldiers arrive in the battlefield where the battle's going on because they've been walking back for the night march.
Good grief.
And they hear Cumberland's new musical commission, which is 236 kettle drums, which he puts out at the front. And they can hear them, of course, from about 3 or 4 miles away. His answer to the pipes.
And is it the case that even an hour or so before the battle began, Lord George Murray was so concerned about the location and thought it was so wrong that he was still trying to suggest alternatives?
He was unhappy, but kind of at this stage, he said, we're going to put an end to a very bad affair. We're going to turn out and fight, and then we're going to get beaten. That was his inspirational message.
We're not going to go into detail about the Battle of Culloden. We don't have the time, and it would take more than one podcast, presumably, to do it justice. But can you give us a précis of the numbers in the sides which lined up and of the casualties?
So there were 4,500 Jacobites, roughly speaking, because many of them are away or haven't gone
still
back.
Still trying to march back.
Yes, or some of them are actually trying to get the French gold, which has landed in the north. So there are about 4,500 on the field. There are about 8,000 British Army. The basic approach taken by Cumberland's commanders, and I think probably the credit should go to General Bland, is not to use the cavalry straight away, as they'd used it at Falkirk and Preston Pans, to hold back the cavalry and then to try and envelop the Jacobite army because of their strength. The big cavalry strength, the Jacobites no longer had very much in the way of cavalry. The big cavalry strength allowed for their envelopment. And the Jacobites resisted the envelopment. It was not successfully carried out, but that's more or less all they did. They did break the British front line on the left, but not on the British left, but not on the other side. On the day, probably about 1,000 Jacobites died, and officially 50 members of the British Army, though in reality, I see there are a significant number of people who seem to be mortally wounded and died very soon afterwards. So probably a safer saying 150 to 250. The thing was not that 1,000 were killed on the day. Another 1,500 were killed in the next 48 hours because the wounded were killed, where orders were given for the wounded to be killed on the battlefield.
And that's why we come to butcher Cumberland.
Yes, exactly. And the massacre on the road to Inverness. So most of the Jacobite casualties happen in the days following the battle rather than on the battlefield itself that day.
On that note, there is a quote attributed to Murray before the battle that the Jacobites should give no quarter. Can you explain the significance of this? And was it even said? Because that is used by Cumberland latterly to say, well, we had to do this because they were going to do the same.
Well, there were orders which were allegedly signed by Lord George Murray saying to give the Elector of Hanover's troops no quarter whatsoever. That was not the practice of the Jacobite army at any other engagement. Murray himself had been with the prince to the forefront in trying to stop people being killed at Preston Pans and to prevent them being killed in the pursuit and to save their lives. It was a forgery. We can't say that it was authorised by Cumberland, but it suited his purposes and extensive use is made of it.
A bit of spin, perhaps, after the fact.
A bit of spin, absolutely. But it didn't help him in the end.
During the battle, what happened to Murray?
So Murray, deciding that all was lost, what would he do if all was lost? Well, he did what Murray tended to do in these circumstances, which is he charged. And
he's a complex, contrary man, isn't he?
He certainly is. So he and the portion of the Atholl Brigade who went with him captured some of the cannon in the front line, and then his horse was shot from under him. And he continued to fight on, came back, rallied the Écossais Royal, the Scottish troops in the French service, and had a last-ditch firefight in the second line to keep back the cavalry envelopment, after which he escaped the battlefield.
So he escaped, the prince escaped, not together, unsurprisingly.
No, not together. No.
Did each man blame the other for the outcome?
The prince thought he'd been betrayed by Lord George Murray.
Specifically, how?
That Lord George Murray was, frankly, continued to be a Hanoverian loyalist and was acting as a fifth columnist throughout the campaign, and he was more and more convinced of that. And some of the princes...
Do you think there's any truth in that?
No, because Lord George Murray got no rewards, frankly. And moreover, he was substantially so committed a Jacobite that France even wanted to use him in 1759. So the prince's view was supported by others. For example, John Roy Stewart, who commanded the Edinburgh Regiment, calls him Lord George Murray, that flatterer of merciless guile, which is yet another depiction of Murray. But the prince's order was to rally at Rivon in Badenoch, and the troops rallied there the next day but one, I think 18th of April, and all they received from him at that point was a sauve qui peut order, let every man look after himself. And Lord George Murray then wrote him a stinker of a letter saying, it's all your fault. Why have you left us all in the lurch? That was frankly the complete end of their relationship.
Murray and the prince eventually ended up in the continent. Murray had a relationship with the prince's father,
yes,
the old pretender, as he's called. He got the Pope to give Murray support,
yes,
I understand.
Yes.
But meanwhile, Prince Charles is writing to his dad saying, that man should be thrown in jail.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes, he is. King James in most of Europe was very fond of Murray, and he regarded him as a loyal supporter. There are some biographers of Charles Edward, Frank McLean is perhaps the most prominent among them, who really argue that Charles had got some kind of, you know, Freudian father complex, and he just couldn't deal with older men. And there is something of a pattern in his, that
yes,
with the Earl Marshal, with Lord George Murray, he finds older generation Jacobites who have an assumption of wisdom and authority really annoying, because basically he thought they were all losers. That's why we're still here.
I see.
Yeah, what we need is new, inspiriting young ideas.
Ah, the
and that's
youth
me.
Of today,
exactly.
Yes, or the youth of the 18th century,
yes,
twas ever that.
Yes.
So what happens then to Murray? He gets some money from the Pope. What then?
Well, he effectively goes into retirement in the Netherlands. In Medemblik, he dies in 1760 when his sons are commissioned in the Dutch brigades. His family join him out there because his wife and children are thrown out of Blair Castle by the Duke in late 1746, early 1747. So they just go and join Murray on the continent.
And does Murray remain a Jacobite until his dying day? Because if there was ever a time to finally turn coat, that was it.
Well, there is a last major Jacobite rising that doesn't happen and yet does happen, which is the sending of the French invasion fleet from Brest to attack England in 1759 and restore the Stuarts. And Lord George Murray is canvassed as a commander on that expedition, though he doesn't actually take up the offer. But he's regarded as a strong enough Jacobite to be worth canvassing.
So in its simplest form, you have two men who just did not like each other, involved in a seismic battle, which was a turning point in British history.
Yes, it is. And it's a turning point, too, in the history of the world, because the outcome, understanding Jacobitism in international context, Jacobitism is the arm of French foreign policy that seeks to create a set of British kingdoms where Ireland and Scotland are fully separate kingdoms, and we have a united state, we have a kind of multi-kingdom monarchy, and also one which is at peace with France. And therefore, you don't get the Seven Years' War, and you don't get the final battle for who is top dog in the European empires. You get an amicable, hopefully, division of the spoils between France and Great Britain. So you can get to a situation where there is no Seven Years' War, there is no American War of Independence because the French are still in Canada and the Americans can't afford the threat, and you get no French Revolution because the French don't run out of money, and then you get no Napoleon. It's wonderful how you can go on like this. I'm not suggesting all these things are necessarily the case, but there isn't any doubt, not so much with Culloden, but if the Jacobites had won, that would have changed the face of British and global history.
Professor Murray Pittock, thank you for taking us through the life and career of Lord George Murray.
Thank you very much, Jackie.
And if we've inspired you to perhaps work out where you'd have positioned your Jacobite army, why not visit Culloden itself? It is such an atmospheric place and is in the care of the National Trust for Scotland. And if you love history, why not subscribe to the Love Scotland podcasts? We publish every 2 weeks. The big names are all there. Robert the Bruce, Mary Queen of Scots, James the First and Sixth, and everything in between, from the Romans to World War II. That's all from me, Jackie Bird, and from Love Scotland for now. Until next time, goodbye. And if you'd like to know more about the events before and after Culloden, we have a clutch of podcasts in Love Scotland archive, including Flora MacDonald, Young Rebel, the fascinating afterlife of the young woman who ferried her fleeing prince over the sea to Sky.
These Hanoverian officers and men are within a mile or so of Charles Edward, and he looks a total ruffian. He's covered in midge bites, he's unshaven, he's a mess, and he's been sleeping in the heather, hasn't slept in a bed since Culloden. And Flora says, help, help, help him.
Love Scotland is brought to you by Think and Demos Productions on behalf of the National Trust for Scotland, presented by Jackie Burt. For show notes and more information, go to nts.org.uk and don't forget to like, subscribe, review and share.